This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the American drug war, particularly as it applies to Honduras and the recent coup.
Honduras has the highest murder rate in the world. What's the cause? The U.S.? The drug war? What is it?
We continue our discussion of the just-published visionary book, Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. We speak with Kazembe Balogun.
In a remarkable essay called, We Be Reading Marx Where We From, Socialism and the Black Freedom Struggle, Kazembe gives a great analysis of Marx and the Black Freedom Struggle.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the revelations on the National Security Agency and what it does and who it spies on just keeps coming out and coming out and coming out. Bring us up to date on the latest.
In terms of finding out about what our government's doing to all of us, I said to some of the journalists who were doing the reporting, I said, hey, you guys, it's like Christmas every day here. I mean, it's great to get this stuff out. It's depressing in the sense of what the government is doing to all of us, but it's remarkable what's going on. The latest story from The Intercept, which is the new online magazine formed by Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, and Jeremy Scahill, is an article co-authored by Glenn Greenwald. And it's documents relating to the NSA, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and what they call, or the NSA calls, its human networks that support WikiLeaks. And it's essentially a series of documents that talk about how the NSA wants to destroy WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and the supporters. And I'll just mention three things in those documents that are important. One set of documents is called the Manhunting Timeline. Well, who should know, but we should suspect that the NSA has a timeline that talks about who they're going to locate, disable, or kill. And on that list are people you would suspect they'd put on that list that you hear about all the time, claimed Al-Qaeda people, etc. But there's also Palestinians on that list, and there's also Julian Assange on that list, the manhunting timeline. In his case, they don't claim that they're going to kill him, which you never know with these guys, but they talk about going after him in every way they can and getting other countries in the world to prosecute Julian Assange, whether that be the UK, Australia, the United States. So that's one document. A second document has this incredibly odd name. It's called the Anti-Crisis Girl. What is that about? Anti-Crisis Girl, G-I-R-L. What that is, that's not run by the NSA. That's run by the GCHQ. That's the British Intelligence Agency. And what that does, and we don't know how it's been implemented completely, but in a display of it and some slides from it, what that allows, or what the GCHQ does, and it shares with the NSA, it's what you would call a dragnet on all the human networks that go through fiber optics cables. To be specific, if I'm doing a search for WikiLeaks on my computer, or if I'm visiting the WikiLeaks website, they take in who's doing the visiting, how long they're visiting it for, and they begin their so-called metadata tree on all of us who look for WikiLeaks. Now, as I said, we don't know whether this is continuing, how it's continuing. We do know that they did it for a number of days as sort of an experiment. We don't have the document that proves that it's happening all the time. But think about that. Every single person, is it 10,000, is it 100,000, who go on their search engine, Google or otherwise, and look for WikiLeaks, your IP address gets tracked by the NSA. Think about that. You're all innocent. None of you have done anything wrong. They can't even suspect you of anything. And yet they're gathering your interests in WikiLeaks. That's document two. Document three is a document. Let's just call it the malicious foreign actor document.
What is that?
I'll say it again. Malicious foreign actor. The NSA has a designation that they give to certain groups or individuals called, quote, malicious foreign actor. And there was a discussion with the NSA surveillance people and the NSA chief counsel, can we designate WikiLeaks as a malicious foreign actor? Now, we do know from the same document that they have designated Anonymous, the, quote, hacktivist group, as a malicious foreign actor. And what it means in an NSA context is that they're allowed to use everything they can to surveil the group or person. So that means if I'm an attorney and having a conversation with my client who's been designated a malicious foreign actor, there's no restrictions on what the NSA can surveil, my conversations, my emails, everything with my client, everything. That's the first level. I think the second level is that if you look at it in other contexts, this is an NSA context, and of course they're not a dirty, supposedly they're not a dirty tricks, they're a surveillance organization, but you can imagine what that means perhaps for the NSA or the military. Once a person's been designated that, does it mean they can be droned? Does it mean they can be kidnapped? What does it mean in other agencies? We don't know. But those three documents taken together make it clear what an earlier document said in 2008, WikiLeaks must be destroyed. And that's our message from the NSA to WikiLeaks. And for us, the lawyers for Julian Assange, and knowing where he is now, what it does is it justifies 100% why he sought asylum in the Ecuador embassy and why the Ecuadorians gave him asylum. He gets into the hands of the United States, and he is in real, real trouble. So again, these new revelations, awful as they are, they do justify why Julian Assange needed and got asylum.
Michael, there's another aspect of the new revelations that I wanted to ask you about, and that's the economic spying that the NSA is doing in conjunction with its allies in Australia, New Zealand, and England. There's an old saying, I think it goes back to Marx, that the government is the executive committee of the ruling class. And in this instance, it seems to me that the NSA is acting as that executive committee and giving economic information on the rivals of American capital to American corporations. What do we know about this now that we didn't know about it before?
Ed Snowden said Americans will be surprised as they learn more and more about the spying, that a lot of it was on economic spying, trade spying, and nothing to do at all with stopping terrorists. And that's come out a little bit before this last week. There was spying on Petrobras, which is the Brazilian oil company. There was some on the trade talks and the trade representatives of the European Union. There's been a few implications that the U.S. is engaged in economic spying. The one this week was not just the economic spying. It was economic spying on a law firm that was giving advice to the Indonesian government about how to deal with, there's two products. One was shrimp, and the other, I think, is cloves, but that doesn't sound
clove right. Cigarettes.
It was a law firm that it was suspected was a law firm called Mayer Brown, which is a big law firm in Chicago, which actually helped the center on the Guantanamo cases, that their conversations with Indonesia about the trade restrictions or trade imports or WTO or trade regulations were surveilled actually by Australia, Australia's signals intelligence. Australia signals intelligence writes to the United States saying, you know, we're picking up all these attorneys from your country talking about this trade stuff. What do you think? Well, what do you think? You got a rubber stamp from our wonderful United States essentially saying, no problem, give us, take everything you want, give it to us, etc. So economic spying, not just economic spying, but economic spying on lawyers giving legal advice to another country on implications of its trade deals.
But that leads me to another question, Michael, and that's the years ago the center brought a lawsuit that failed, alleging that the NSA was spying on the attorney-client discussions that the center was having with its clients in Guantanamo. And the government threw the case out, the judge threw the case out, saying that it was speculative. Well, it seems to me that it's no longer speculative.
You know, our case got thrown out. An ACLU case came very close, lost in the Supreme Court on the same issue, 5-4, on the issue of whether a person who actually doesn't know they're surveilled but fits the criteria for being surveilled, does that person have a right to go to court to challenge the policy? So far, we've lost it. We're getting closer and closer to the smoking gun, because after this, saying, well, they just don't care whether they're doing attorneys or not. In fact, they want to do them. It seems we're closer. Hopefully, we're there. And in fact, one of the things we at the center have done, that case that you're talking about, the center brought, was our relations with our Guantanamo clients, because and their families in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, wherever, because we know that those are 100% surveilled. It's just a given, even though we can't give you the piece of paper. So we brought that lawsuit. We lost. We have a similar one in mind with regard to our client, Julian Assange. He's sitting in the Ecuador embassy. He's a foreigner. We know that under the criteria they use, he's being surveilled. We also know that attorney-client calls are being surveilled, and here's why. There's a concept called minimization. When they're surveilling my conversation with Julian Assange or with somebody, let's say I represent someone in the United States, when they're surveilling my or your conversation, Michael, with a client in the U.S., and they hear that it's an attorney talking to that person about attorney-client material, they have to minimize or stop listening to it. Now, what they say with regard to people who are overseas who are our clients is they only have to stop listening to it if there's an indictment of that person, not if we're simply giving them legal advice. So, and I'm willing to bet if it's a public indictment of that person. So in the case of Julian Assange, there's no evidence at this point of a public indictment. Yes, we think he's likely indicted by a grand jury sitting in the United States, but it's not public yet. So our guess is the NSA is taking in all my conversations, all the center's conversations with Julian, and saying, well, there's no public indictment. It's a secret indictment. We don't know about it, quote, and therefore we'll continue to take in all the conversations. So we just have had the discussion. Yes, at some point, as we get closer and closer, this seems to me completely illegal and unconstitutional, and we should be able to get him on it. It's also something that says if and when they were to ever get Julian on trial, which hopefully will never happen, is it would seem to me a very good defense to say, you guys have been listening to our attorney-client conversations forever. So the country, Michael, as you and I have pointed out many times, sinks deeper and deeper into the abyss of lawlessness and scum.
Last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights hosted an event titled The Drug War, Policing and U.S. Militarism at Home and Abroad. We're joined today by two of the panelists, David Vivar, who is an author and a scholar at National Autonomous University of Honduras, and also on the Faculty of International Relations at the University of Calabria. His work focuses on the U.S. cooperation in the Honduran military coup of 2009 and the centrality of drug trafficking to state power in Honduras. We're also joined by Laura Raymond. Laura is the program manager at the Center for Constitutional Rights and has been doing work with respect to Honduras since 2009.
David Vivar and Laura Raymond, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So, David, I know you've been traveling a lot. I know you're an expert on Honduras, and we're going to have a discussion with you about what's going on in Honduras, particularly the intersection of U.S. politics, the drug war, the new president. But I want to start with a contemporary issue that's just come up, which is in January, our Congress passed a law, or at least added to some appropriation bill, a clause about Honduras obeying human rights or getting better on human rights or something like that, and if it doesn't, cutting off 35% of the aid. Can you just tell us what that is and then start with the background of how Honduras got to this point in getting a law like that passed?
It's been constant that the Congress asks for respect of human rights and to stop human right violations, but this goes all the way back to the simulation we have of the rule of law, to the simulation of a constitutional democratic state. In this sense, you can ask the government and government institutions to stop violating human rights and to take care of their citizens, but impunity and justice is the main factor that maintains the situation on the same level.
And is Honduras so bad right now in human rights? I mean, we don't read
we have
the, almost anything about it here.
We have the highest murder rate in the world, and we have no war, not a consistent war declared, except the war on drugs. So we're fighting a war that has turned the current conditions into a civil war. And a civil war that has a lot of government violence and government corruption and government impunity. I'm speaking about the military, I'm speaking about the policemen, and I'm speaking about corporate enterprises that have interests involved in land and resources that keep the situation
the same.
When
you say a civil war, who's the civil war between?
Well, that's how they picture it. They picture that organized crime is the war between kingpins and kingpins, drug lords and maras, which is other phenomena that we have.
Let's go back with 3-4 years when the coup happened. Who were the good guys and who were the bad guys, and what was the United States' involvement?
Well, the involvement of the United States was quite warm, so to speak. It was Obama's first try into Latin American politics, and he was basically very cowardly saying, okay, there was a coup, but afterwards he said, like, okay, we're just going to take out the military aid we have, which worsened the situation, because without enforcement of the DEA and its support to Honduran military, the levels of how much aircrafts were taking drugs via Honduras just rise to unexpected levels.
Let me see if I understand that. We had the coup in 2009.
Yes.
Zelaya's tossed out.
Yes.
And then U.S. stops military aid? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, they stopped military aid in order to say, like, okay, we whitewash our hands and we just don't support military coups anymore. But the problem was the drug market. The drug market started, well, they certainly knew the opportunity that broke open by taking out military aid, and the levels of how much drugs were taken through to the states through Honduras just raised.
And that's continuing till today?
Ever since 1982, we were one of the biggest states in the sense of how much help we got military from the United States. Just Colombia gets much more money than we do. And the Northern Triangle has suffered specifically the consequences of Plan Colombia taking place in Colombia and the Mérida Initiative in Mexico. Plan Colombia is from the early 90s. The Mérida Initiative is from the late 90s. So when you start having conflicts between drug lords on the Mexican cartels and the Colombian cartels, what do? They go to the space right in the middle, which is us, Central America and the Northern Triangle. So Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have seen the consequences. We are the collateral damage.
So the U.S. did cut off military aid for a short amount of time directly after the coup, but then instead of backing the huge movement from Honduran civil society for a reinstatement of President Zelaya, throughout that summer and the fall, there was a huge movement. The streets were filled. I mean, you were there. It's almost every day, just people calling for the reinstatement of their president. The United States instead pushed for new elections that fall, which is what ended up happening. The elections were widely boycotted by civil society, yet the U.S. was kind of the primary force in the region for supporting those elections. They were one of the only governments in the world to support the elections. Even the U.N., the Carter Center, did not observe them or recognize them. And so after those elections took place and Pepe Lobo was elected as president, the U.S. reinstated their support for the Honduran military and police despite massive human rights violations that were taking place on an almost daily basis. I mean, you had tons and tons of protesters rounded up in detention. Human rights were being violated left and right. There was a lot of reporting going on from the Center for Constitutional Rights and other human rights organizations. And the U.S. ignored those reports and became really the biggest ally in the region of the Honduran government. And so to this day, that funding of the police and military continues. There's a few new military bases in Honduras, U.S. military bases. So you really have like a very close relationship now between the Honduran military and police and the U.S. government and military.
Where do drugs come in? Where are they coming from? What are they doing in Honduras? Where they're going to? Who profits from it? What's the relationship with the United States government and its policy and the drug dealing? Let's talk about that.
Well, in order to establish the background, we would have to go strictly to the Iran-Contra affair. Remember?
Oh, sure. All the way back to Ronald Reagan in the 1980s.
Yeah, specifically. And what is more important to notice is the change of the enemy. back in the 70s, the U.S. allowed Latin American drug lords to take drugs to the U.S. in order to send back weapons and economic relief for the U.S.-trained Contras. That was in the 80s,
right.
Yeah. So this started the market. And it started the market, which its consumption was not in Central America. The final objective is the U.S. people. So this was continued, even though the Iran-Contra affair broke the alliance between the CIA, the U.S. government, and the drug lords. By the end of the 1980s, we start seeing reactivation of DEA in its war against these drug lords. There's a paradigmatic case with Ramon Bata Ballesteros, who was incarcerated and illegally taken out of Honduras before it had an extradition law. And he was taken to Puerto Rico, and from Puerto Rico he was taken to the United States. This has not changed. The enemy changed slightly in the rhetorical sense from the counterinsurgency enemy. We've changed to narco-insurgency. And right now, the criminalization and the discrimination of our people in the sense of domestic drug policy is basically objectifying campesinos and African indigenous communities that are losing land to drug lords and to the state that, well, belongs to them.
That brings me to the only thing that Americans probably have ever read about in the last couple of years in Honduras, which is the Awas massacre or Awas killings. And that, I think what you're saying is sort of, those were, I guess, campesinos as well. Something about, you're mentioning about taking land, but there were allegations, of course, after they, why don't you tell what's happened to them for people who don't remember those set of murders?
Well, Awas happened May 11, 2012, and it was the killing of four innocent civilians. They were told that they were carrying guns and they were shooting the DEA helicopter that was above them, and they were just massacred.
They were in a like a canoe or something in a river, right?
Yes. The Mosquitia region, the former land where the Contras were trained,
right.
It's basically in the middle of the jungle, virgin jungle in Honduras, where a lot of land strips are taken and converted into landing stripes. Cubisque, which is U.S. Ambassador in Honduras, basically says that there's involvement of the populations in the drug trafficking.
Now, one of the things that happened is 58 members of Congress signed something at the time saying we want a full investigation, we want the DEA to come forward. And there is an investigation. Is it still going on? Is DEA cooperating with it?
There was a Honduran investigation that a lot of human rights organizations have criticized, actually, for not fully investigating all the details, for doing a very poor job with the forensic evidence. And also the United States has not cooperated with that Honduran investigation. They haven't made the names of people who are involved in the mission available, for example. But the United States itself has not done any investigation. And that was actually the call from the Congress members, was for a U.S. investigation, because the Honduran investigation was considered so poor that there was a need for the U.S. to investigate its own operation there. But the U.S., as David is saying, is kind of washing their hands and distancing itself from the operation, which really was a United States DEA operation involving Honduran agents. So, but they're trying to say it was the opposite, that it was a Honduran operation involving some DEA agents.
Now, bringing us up to today, are there still like these kind of drug operations going on all over Honduras right now, of these helicopters, of these landing strips? Is it still a central place for the transport, supposedly, of drugs from...
Yes, 79% of the cocaine that travels to the United States goes via Honduras.
Does it really? Wow.
That's yes.
That's an extraordinary figure.
Well, that's part of the problem, because the United States has established this relation with the Honduran authorities. And Honduran authorities, and basically this simulation of constitutional democratic state that we have, is just completely flawed. 2 years ago, the son of the university's dean was killed by policemen. And the military, ever since the Iran-Contras affair, have been directly involved with drug trafficking. So basically, what the Department of State is doing is investing money on kingpins and drug lords in the Honduran institutions. And this is basically why interdiction and why the operations they're holding in Honduran territory are absolutely flawed, because the institutionality of the military and the policemen is corrupted.
Because when we talked about right after the coup, you said the U.S. military cut off the aid for a while and the drug lords started to flourish because the military wasn't able to work on stopping them. But now I think what you're saying is the situation has changed. Now the military is essentially at one with the drug lords. Is that right?
Now the military, after the coup, the military basically took back power. And the United States have constantly supported this new democratical military civil alliance, which in the end is what happened in Mexico before with Calderón. And you see right now the mess Mexico is involved with the autodefensas and the whole fight between civil society that in the end had or started just taking guns and fighting on their own, the military and the drug lords.
I want to go deeper into that.
Okay.
We have the military. It's being armed by the United States. They're using the military to some extent to kill people like in Aguas, yes. And they're also using it to stop people taking drugs through Honduras, even though they don't seem to be very successful if 79% of the cocaine is going through there. But to what extent is the military cooperating with the drug lords?
The military has drug lords of its own. I think on the last 20 years, only 5 of this military officers have been prosecuted. But they have been liberated and killed afterwards in order to shut their mouths. This whole problem has been worsening because this whole simulation of democracy that we have, supported by the U.S., is just making impunity grow in levels that we have never seen before. And the direct relation between the military, the police, the drug lords, and the enterprises, basically, are, in the case of indigenous populations, taking land of these populations, the land that it's used for cropping and for survival, and giving them for monocropping, which, in the end, is the easiest way to establish basically the pickup service they do from Colombia to Honduras to the United States.
Why don't you talk about that a little more? I'm, who's taking the land of the indigenous people?
One of the major figures, and that I think it's the best figure we can use in order to understand the relation between politics, military, and drugs, is Miguel Facusé. Miguel Facusé is the most powerful man in Honduras. He's got the Dinant Corporation, which has African palm plantations throughout this whole the drug path, which is La Mosquitia and Colón. Basically, the conflict around land is a failed agrarian reform. So you have indigenous populations that lost their land. Their land was given to this businessman and the most powerful person in Honduras. He gets the African palm plantations, which is the best place, as we know, thanks to WikiLeaks, to establish small airports for aircrafts to land there and to deal with the drugs.
What David is bringing up is a really key point in that Miguel Facusé, I mean, there have known to be drug planes that have landed on his property. We know that the U.S. State Department knows about that because of WikiLeaks. And the U.S. goes on to have this cozy relationship with him and kind of the political arm of Honduras that he runs in. The World Bank continues to fund him and give him subsidies for the African palm plantations. And so it's really kind of like, where is the interest here in actually stopping the drugs if you are working with this person who there's drug planes landing on his property? And also, I mean, the level of crime that Miguel Facusé has really pushed forward in that region of Honduras. I mean, he has a private army, basically. He has all these private security contractors that are implicated in murders. The Center for Constitutional Rights has actually laid those out in a report to the International Criminal Court that we submitted, naming Miguel Facusé as a very kind of criminal figure that needs to be prosecuted, and that the Honduran government is basically giving carte blanche to kind of run this operation in the Aguan Valley.
So, Laura, how would you, in a nutshell, describe American policy towards Honduras now? Is it sincerely an anti-drug policy? Is it sincerely a pro-democratic policy? Is it something else? What is the United States government actually doing?
Mm-hmm. I think the U.S. policy towards Honduras has been, since the 80s, a very close relationship. I mean, the United States depends on their relationship with the Honduran government to have a very friendly government in the region. We have a lot of military presence there. We have multiple bases. We depend on that relationship, given kind of the other governments in the area, which have taken more left-wing paths in their governments. So at this point, it's a very, very close relationship. I would not say it's a democratic relationship. I mean, this is a continuation of a coup government. And so it's a relationship that depends on kind of the repression of civil society throughout Honduras. There's a mass resistance movement that has really taken a lot of repression in the last 4 years.
And violence all the way from Mexico to Colombia, specifically on these three countries, Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. We are the people that my people is dying over there. As I was telling you before, they've been accused by the U.S. ambassador of being involved in drugs just to whitewash whatever operation, military operation they're doing. 2 weeks ago, the head of the Southern Command flew to Honduras, and because the Honduras military opened fire against this drug aircraft. What he said was, okay, if you keep on firing, open fire with these airplanes, we're going to stop the military aid. Why? Because we have undercover agents inside the airplane, so you cannot kill our agents.
That's what, in the drug airplanes, yes. They have undercover agents. Wow.
There's been a new president in Honduras now, right?
Yes.
It was an election, right, to bring that person in? So what's your thoughts about the new president, the elections?
Well, we have to go immediately back to 2009. 2009, the United States was one of the only countries that kept its ambassador there. Diplomatically speaking, that is basically to support the Putschist regime that took power afterwards. The elections were done under the Putschist regime. The National Party won those elections, which were boycotted by the social movement. Even though the social movement decided to take a chance by creating a party and participating on these elections, there was a massive fraud going on. In the end, the same story repeats. We finish up legitimizing the continuation of a Putschist regime. This person, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is much more cynical in his stance towards the opening for business Honduras in the sense of neoliberal policies and pro-military policies that he's just taking. And the repression continues. The social movement is basically the strongest movement ever seen since the 54.
I was going to ask you about the resistance. I mean, that's where you're going to.
But yeah.
Because it sounds pretty terrible right now, so I'm just interested in what the fight back is.
Well, the fight back, it took two sides, basically. The electoral side, which is with the creation of a political party, but the resistance is still on the streets. It's still going on because the militarization and the opening for business of the country with a lot of laws like model cities and charter cities and this kind of laws are something we're fighting back. Fighting back in the sense of keeping our resources ours, because we're just letting go everything from this Putschist continuation regime.
You described Plan Colombia and then Plan Merida, I guess you were talking about.
Yeah.
And I don't think our listeners are probably familiar with Merida, Plan Merida. I know it's a city in Mexico, but other than that, somehow Honduras is being squeezed between the drug lords in one area and another. So just elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, the Merida Initiative basically started with Clinton. Afterwards, the PRI, which is Vicente Fox, and afterwards Felipe Calderón, militarized the Mexican society. And what happened was that the drug lords, the cartels, because they had such a big enemy, having the military against them, they just moved their operations to Central America. And now you have this enemies of the U.S. war on drugs living and hiding in Honduras, in Guatemala, and El Salvador. And the same happened with Plan Colombia. The war taken on Colombia's indigenous populations and with the FARC and the guerrilla there, they just make the cartel move their operations all the way to Central America, specifically on the Northern Triangle, which is Guatemala, Salvador, and Honduras.
Well, I just wanted to kind of go off of what David was saying about the resistance movement. And I was down in Honduras around the elections this past November, which ultimately Juan Orlando Hernandez was named president. But there was a lot of, again, the resistance movement in the streets saying actually there was massive fraud and this is not our president. It's just really amazing to go down to Honduras these days and see really the presence, and the presence you see everywhere is the resistance movement. And it is Honduran civil society. It's every sector involved, the unions to the women's groups to indigenous rights groups to human rights groups. I mean, every single sector, youth are very involved. I mean, that really is what's running civil society at this stage. They have their own political party, which, you know, they claim actually was the legitimate winner of the election. And so it's inspiring. I mean, what's going on, obviously, politically and with the drug wars, it's very dark and scary. But the other side of the story is this amazing movement that David is part of and that a lot of amazing people are part of. And so that's kind of what here in the United States is our goal working with the Honduran Solidarity Network is to really support that movement and be in solidarity.
Anywhere they can get more information, et cetera?
Well, you have amazing academics and people like Laura working very close to us Hondurans. So, well, you have the WikiLeaks, you have the internet, you have a lot of information, you have a lot of alternative media that's telling the real story going behind the drug wars and the Honduran democratic elections and whatever.
I know the CCR website also has mm-hmm. a lot on Honduras. What's that, Laura?
Yeah, we have it's ccrjustice.org/Honduras coup, and we have a lot of information, human rights reports, things of that nature.
Well, thank you. It's probably one of our more unreported stories in the United States altogether, I mean. But thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In the past few weeks, we've featured contributors to the book Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. This visionary book was conceived by Francis Golden and edited by Francis, Debbie Smith, and me, Michael Smith. We continue to discuss the essays in this groundbreaking anthology today with Kazembe Balogun. Kazembe wrote the chapter, We Be Reading Marx, Where We Come From, Socialism and the Black Freedom Struggle. Kazembe is a political activist and cultural organizer from the Bronx. He's the former program director at the Breck Forum and currently serves as the head of the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation here in New York City. Kazembe Balogun, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Kazembe, you wrote a real good chapter in our new book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And I wanted to ask you about the chapter. You know, Black history, this is Black History Month, actually, but Black history has largely been a hidden history up until recent times. But even more hidden has been the history of Black socialists and Black radicals. Your chapter is a lot about that. And I wanted to ask you what your thinking was that went in behind the chapter that you wrote.
Well, thank you so much. You know, the chapter starts out with this a small short story with Paul Robeson appearing at the Carnegie Hall in 1957. And I, the reason I chose that particular point in time because he himself had gone through a tremendous amount of erasure through the McCarthy period and during the Cold War. And it was a certain type of resurgence in his voice that he gave a concert at Carnegie Hall that was sold out. And he sang a song called I Dreamed of Joe Hill Last Night. And that song has always been a tremendous, powerful song for protest and of inquiry. But one of the biggest things for me was like looking at a specific time that African-American artists and activists always naming their place and naming their history. And I felt like that was a good place to start around talking about socialism and the African-American freedom struggle. Many people don't know, but when you talk about Wall Street, you know, the first commodities sold on Wall Street were black slaves. The reason they called it Wall Street was because to keep the Native Americans out. From the very early part of the abolitionist movement, there were German emigres and socialists who were involved in that movement. And moving forward onwards, there's always been this interweaving of black freedom struggles in the socialist experience.
Well, you know, Kazembe, I'm from Wisconsin.
Right.
And in 1848, a lot of German revolutionaries came to Wisconsin after the failure of the uprising in Germany. And, you know, they actually formed a brigade, these socialist Germans, and went down south to fight in the Civil War for black emancipation. So it goes all the way back, you know, 150-some years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the first socialist experiments happens in the Sea Islands of South Carolina and Georgia with General Butler issuing Article 15, calling for all land held in common to Negroes. Then you have John Brown in 1863, just before his raid. I believe in 1859, going back for his raid, issuing an alternative constitution of the United States, which calls for all land to be held in common between blacks and whites. So you have this whole entire history, like you mentioned, of this kind of cross-fertilization of black freedom struggles and socialism, which is really amazing.
Let's talk about some more obscure facts that people don't know. The most famous intellectual in American history, Albert Einstein, was a socialist. But what about Martin Luther King?
Yeah, Martin Luther King. I mean, this chapter is very interesting to think about Martin Luther King. First of all, in 1967, he gives a major speech on celebrating the 100 years of W.E.B. Du Bois. And one of the things he says is that we can't understand Du Bois without him understanding him as a communist, that he was a genius who chose to be a communist. Then you have MLK saying that this has to be some form of socialism in the United States in order to achieve economic democracy. So, I mean, these are, again, examples of parts of history that we don't know about. And obviously, you know, the Poor People's March going forward in 1968 and his fight for Memphis. I mean, these are all part of pillars of economic democracy.
Let's talk about Malcolm X. It's another hidden history. And you have a quote that you put in your chapter in Imagine Living in a Socialist USA from Malcolm. And Kazembe Balogun, I'd like you to read that quote, if you would, please.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. So in the 1960s, well, the quote reads, "It's impossible for a chicken to produce an egg." Malcolm said at a Harlem rally. A duck egg. "Is it possible for a chicken to produce a duck egg?" he said at a Harlem rally in 1964. And then he also continued, "The system of this country cannot produce freedom for an African American. It is impossible for this system, this economic system, this political system, this social system, this system, period. It is impossible for it, as it is now stands, to produce freedom right now for the black man in this country. It is impossible. And if ever a chicken did produce a duck egg, I'm certainly, you would say it was certainly a revolutionary chicken."
Malcolm was nothing if not funny.
Exactly.
But I think you take from that the truth that Malcolm and Martin Luther King were really converging on the notion that you can't have formal political democracy without having an economic democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the key factors in like Malcolm's evolution and Marlon's evolution is that they went from this idea of civil rights to human rights. And they understood that the fact that you could not talk about the civil without talking about economic and social justice. And it led them more and more towards socialism and socialist ideas. And what we find today, even today, is that, you know, these socialist ideas are very much prevalent in the African-American community. You know, there was that famous Pew Research poll that said that a majority of young people are interested in socialism. Well, there's a supermajority of African-Americans who are interested in socialism, you know, because of their lived experiences of racism and economic oppression in the society. So I think that there's a way in which we have to really kind of excavate this kind of history of our own social movements. And, you know, and further on in the chapter, you know, I talk about folks like Claude McKay and Langston Hughes during the Harlem Renaissance, the ways in which they were interacting with socialism, and as well as a number of different socialist feminists as well, like Angela Davis and the Gabahi River Collective. So it's a very long, rich history.
Yeah, that poll that you mentioned was quite extraordinary. The Pew poll was taken a couple years ago, and they found that young people under the age of 30, 49% had a favorable reaction to the concept of socialism. And it was much higher amongst people of color. And this is 2 years ago, and I would guess that it's even higher now. So I think that we're at a point, and I would ask you if you agree, that ideas of people like you, Kazembe Balogun, and of me, and of the 31 different contributors to the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, these ideas on how every institution in this country would be different, those ideas are receptive now to people, particularly young people in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's amazing. I mean, first of all, I mean, it's really great that this book came out right now, at this particular moment right now, when so many people are open to these new ideas and really opening to this idea of reimagining a different type of society. Because similar to what Malcolm and what Martin Luther King understood was that, you know, this society, this capitalist society, really has little to offer people, particularly young people of color. You know, we're doing this interview some days after Jordan Davis's you know, non-conviction of the murder of Jordan Davis, as well as talking about Trayvon Martin. And we really have to ask the question, well, what kind of society do we want to live in, right? And that becomes a very basic point. Do you want to live in a society that where, you know, it's stand your ground and it's about private property? Or do you want to live in a society that we can really imagine where there's safe spaces for young people, and that young people are cherished? And I think that that's something that we're really kind of trying to envision in a text like Imagine. So I think it's really important.
Yeah, I would say that capitalism, despite its claims, has failed utterly in three respects. It does not guarantee democracy. It doesn't guarantee a better way of life or even a decent way of life. And it doesn't abolish racism. I agree with you. When people start seeing that there's an alternative, then the thing could crash pretty quickly. I remember Maggie Thatcher, Ronald Reagan's buddy, in the 80s in England when she was the prime minister, and she had a concept called TINA. There is no alternative, T-I-N-A, TINA. When people start realizing that, yes, indeed, there is an alternative, that you don't have to have bosses. It's a simple concept, but if you think about it, you know, where you work, people who work there can run it just as easily with no bosses. Rick Wolf has got a chapter in the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, where he talks about how you could democratize these big corporations and have them run by the people who actually work in them. Ron Riasti's got another chapter on how you could democratize the entire economy. These people are unnecessary. There are few, but they're unnecessary. The gap in wealth is extraordinary. The first chapter cites the Walton family, you know, the people that own Walmart. Mm. Well, there are six of them, five sons and daughters and a daughter-in-law. And between the six of them, they are worth $69.3 billion. That is, they're worth more than the entire lower 30% of the American population. Mm. So these six Walmart people are worth more than 90 million people in the United States. So it doesn't guarantee a kind of evening up. Just the reverse. The income differentials and the wealth differentials are getting worse and worse. It doesn't guarantee democracy. Michael Ratner was just talking about the NSA. They know every keystroke you make on the computer, every phone call you make, every Twitter you do. Bernie Sanders was so shocked when this information was coming out that he put a question
to the NSA. He said, "Are you people spying on members of Congress?" And the NSA wouldn't answer him. Former President Jimmy Carter concluded from all of this, and this is a quote, "We're no longer living in a functional democracy." So as between the economic stuff, the democratic, the racist stuff, capitalism is really at a dead end. And it'll get transformed when people realize that there's something different and something better, and that every institution in the society, and this is what the book covers, imagine living in a socialist USA, everything from medical care to housing to sexuality to art, science, technology, education, every institution you could think of was going to be different if it's a society that's not run on the basis of making a profit.
And if I can just respond to that, I think that's a beautiful point. And I think that there's a couple of things. One is that when we talk about the NSA, we also have to talk about the legacy of COINTELPRO and the effects of the black movement and the way that this has been going on for years. And again, it's like communist movements and working class movements in the United States for years, for almost a century now. But another part of it, too, that's really speaking to me from your comments, Michael, is the fact that the United States, the NSA, the spying governments always have us really worried with their spying and their kind of surveillance, and that's a particular type of seeing. And I think that what we want to open up with this book is another type of seeing, which is a vision, right? And opening up a whole entire new space for people can really do, like you say, imagine something different. Something that I always take into account is that there's always been a tradition of an African-American prophetic tradition, which always looks beyond what's actually given to us and looks at the conditions of possibility, right? And I think that in order to build movements and to build legacies of struggle, we have to really kind of engage those really think really, really big. And I think this is what happens within this context of this particular text, this particular book, but also in terms of, like, you know, our overarching history, you know, thinking beyond the borders, right? So I think that, you know, you're hitting on some really good points. And I think that it's important for us to really kind of, like, get that vision out there.
I think what we're talking about, the kind of things we dream of a decent society where there's human solidarity, it goes all the way back to the prophets. It goes all the way back to Isaiah. Mm-hmm. It goes back to Jesus. That's what we're talking about. But you know, I have a funny story for you, Kazembe.
Yeah.
I was speaking 4 months ago before he died, Sal Landau, who was a friend, and I said, "Sal, I want to tell you about this book that I've been working on that's soon to come out. It's called Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. It's really a visionary book, and it's, in essence, you know, when the lion lays down with the lamb." And Sal said, "You know, Michael, if the lion ever lays down with the lamb's not going to get any sleep." But the book was Francis Golden's idea.
Absolutely.
Francis Golden is a literary agent, mm-hmm. and she's Mumia's agent.
Right.
And she's friends with Mumia. She visits him regularly. She published his first book, Live from Death Row.
Right.
And she came to me and my companion, Debbie, and she said, "There's two things I want to do. Mm-hmm. I'm 88 years old, and before I die, I want to get Mumia out of prison, and I want to do a book about what life might be like if we abolish capitalism in the United States." And she said, "And I want to call it Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. And would you and Debbie help me do that?" That was 2 years ago. Now it's come out. And Francis is going to be speaking. Get a pencil, our listeners. Francis is going to be speaking along with Kazembe Balogun February 26th at Cooper Union from 7 to 9 in the Rose Auditorium. Leslie Kagan will be speaking, Steve Wishnia, who wrote the chapter on drugs, Fred Jerome, who wrote the chapter on the media, Joel Covell, who wrote the first chapter, and and I think the most central chapter on eco-socialism, because if we don't solve that situation, all the rest we're never even going to get to. Joel Kazembe, Fred Jerome, Steve Wishnia, Leslie Kagan, who wrote the chapter with Melanie K. Kantrowitz on sexuality in a future society, and Francis Golden, the person who dreamed up this book and who's one of the editors along with me and Debbie Smith. And they're all speaking on Wednesday, February 26th at Cooper Union from 7 to 9 at the Rose Auditorium. That's 41 Cooper Square at East 7th Street. And it's a benefit for St. Mark's Bookstore. So, Kaz, you'll be there, and I hope people will come down and hear you talk about the book and your chapter in it. But I wanted to ask you, do you have some additional thoughts that you wanted to share with us?
You know, I just want to really just thank you for all the wonderful work that you're doing and the wonderful work of the show. It's an important resource in the community. And also, you know, I just want to say hello to my my son, Miles.
Well, with that, Kazemi Balogun, you've written an excellent chapter in our book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. I want to congratulate you on the work you do with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, and before that, when you were a wonderful program director at the Breck Forum. And I wish you well, and we'll be out to hear you speak on Wednesday the 26th at Cooper Union at 7 o'clock. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. Right on.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.